This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. This week's new FBI crime statistics reveal a rather complex picture about Connecticut. While the number of violent crimes overall dropped in 2020, homicides were up 30%. Car thefts also rose pretty sharply by about 42%. And that trend appears to be continuing into this year. And lawmakers are at odds about what to do about it. We've asked journalist Kellen Lyons to bring us up to speed on this story. He's been following the changing crime rates and what's being done about it for the online news site CT Mirror, and he joins us via Zoom. Kellen, hello, and thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Let's begin with the data, if we could. I'd like to refer back to an April article that you wrote, and I understand you've done quite a bit of reporting since then, but back then, you and your colleague, Kasturi Panandjati, a data journalist for CT Mirror, you wrote a comprehensive article on the shrinking prison population in Connecticut, and it compares the crime stats of 2020 with 2019. How did the rates change? What was significant about those two years? Let's begin with the new FBI report. What's significant about what is in that list of data?
Sure. So the data shows that there isn't a crime wave per se in Connecticut, as we may have heard in reports from across the state from Republicans, but it does show that specific types of crimes are up. Shootings appear to have increased, as did motor vehicle thefts, which has sort of been the hot topic of the summer that lawmakers have been discussing at the Capitol and outside. Homicides went up to 108 in 2020, which is up from 77 in 2019. In places like Hartford, homicides did also tick up, but other violent crimes like rape, robbery, aggravated assault, burglary, they're all lower than they've been in the last 4 years. Car thefts, meanwhile, did seem to spike, as they did nationally, but they are significantly below what they were at their peak in the 1990s. They have actually decreased, I believe. There was a 77% decrease in motor vehicle thefts between 1991 and 2019, compared to a 43% reduction nationwide. So there is some nuance in that FBI report that was released. I think we've heard a lot about how there's violent crime is spiking and is causing chaos in the Connecticut streets, but that doesn't seem to be what the case was in 2020. Overall crime actually seemed to decrease in that year, but we did see specific types of crime go up.
Does the data point to locations, places, or regions where the rates have changed significantly, either up or down?
So there's that FBI report doesn't show this specific data point, but some very interesting data has been released that shows that car thefts specifically have changed. They've migrated from the cities into the surrounding suburbs. Those suburbs and more rural communities are typically whiter, more often represented by Republican lawmakers, which seems to suggest that as this crime makes its way out of the cities, which tend to be more represented by Democrats, more represented by progressive Democrats, and have more people of color than in the surrounding towns and in the rural areas, Republicans are starting to make this a bigger issue.
There was quite a dust up, I recall, I think it was in August, when complaints about car thefts, especially by teenagers, got a good deal of attention from lawmakers. And as you mentioned, the data does show that there's a shift from, in some cases, the cities to the suburbs when it comes to car theft. Is there anything to read into that other than a change in location?
Well, Just to give a little bit of context, this all seemed to start out from a jogger being hit and killed in New Britain. So there was a 17-year-old who allegedly ran over a jogger who had been arrested 13 times over 3.5 years. And this young person was charged as an adult. As was the person who was, there was a person who was chasing him who had stolen his, whose wallet had been stolen allegedly by the young person. The young person panicked, ran over a jogger, and then fled the scene on foot. So that set off a firestorm across at the Capitol. There was a massive demonstration by Republicans, police officers, state and local officials. Democrats had a sort of counter protest, which focused mostly on data. And the distinction between those two responses was pretty fascinating to watch. I mean, you see Republicans focusing on more anecdotal information, more sensational individual instances of crime, whereas Democrats are trying to hold the line and focus more on data showing that crime is at historic lows, crime is rising nationally, not just within Connecticut. Republicans, meanwhile, are countering that it doesn't matter what the data shows, crime is up in the sense that people are scared. And so they've been focusing on those individual instances. There's been some pretty nasty individual pieces of crime that have happened in some of the surrounding suburbs that have made a lot of news and attention lately, but there's no data as of right now that's suggesting that that is on the rise or that the state is unsafe. I mean, by most measures, it is safer than it was years ago.
I was going to say, if you happen to be on the receiving end of one of the crimes, then the numbers kind of don't matter to you because you are one of the people who's been victimized, and I guess those people were able to point out that despite the statistics, there are still some problems that they would like their lawmakers to deal with in some way.
Absolutely. I mean, Republicans are saying essentially exactly that they are, just because the numbers are down doesn't mean that people aren't scared, right? It doesn't mean that people aren't afraid when they leave their houses. And there's a lot of data that shows that car thefts of unlocked cars is up significantly, both in Connecticut and nationwide. So a big point has been to simply lock your cars. You know, don't allow for that opportunity for them to be stolen. Republicans are countering that with accusations of victim blaming, and you know they're saying that they want a special session in order to address these issues.
You've been talking about how some of the lawmakers have been responding to the trends, either the ones noted in the data or the perceived trends. Back in April, lawmakers held a forum to address gun violence, and I think that occurred after the very tragic death of a child, a three-year-old, in Hartford. What came from that forum?
So in the legislative session, lawmakers passed a pretty important bill that hasn't quite gone into effect quite yet. But it would allow reimbursement by Medicaid for services provided by certified violence prevention professionals. You know, the thinking nationally is that we've seen an increase in shootings across the country because these sort of patchwork of small scale community programs have been interrupted by COVID, by the pandemic. You know, things like violence interruption programs, community programs, peer support, harm reduction outreach. We've seen a lot of talk about that at the legislature and attempts to try to fund some of those programs after that tragedy. We're also seeing a distinction in what members of each political party is calling for. Republicans, at least in the juvenile debate, have been talking a little bit more about expanding circumstances and crimes for which young people's cases are transferred to adult court, you know, holding them accountable, putting them, you know, incarcerating them or making sure that they are held for extended periods of time in juvenile detention centers. Democrats, meanwhile, they're really focusing on not turning back the dial on the decarceration efforts that they have made over the recent years. You know, they're really reticent to rebuild back mass incarceration and to increase the number of people who are in our state correctional facilities. So they're emphasizing a more comprehensive approach, things like housing supports, employment supports, some of that hospital violence interruption programs and things that I was talking about before. So after those tragedies, after each of these shootings, we've seen press conferences that have been more focused on some of them, those more comprehensive efforts and reforms.
We will be talking during the show today with some community activists in the Fair Haven section of New Haven, where they are employing the violence interruption strategy to try and quell a rise in violence in their immediate neighborhood. So we'll be talking with them a bit later. You mentioned the incarceration numbers in Connecticut, and back in April, you and your colleague Kasturi Panunjati, a data journalist for the Connecticut Mirror, did write an article about the shrinking prison population in the state. Just to touch on that for a moment, what are the differences between 2020 and 2019 when it comes to, how many people are in prison right now, or at that time anyway?
So on March 1st of 2020, there were 12,409 people who were in our state prisons and jails. And that's of note, Connecticut has a unified system, meaning there are no county jails. So all of our correctional facilities are run by our state. So that is everybody who is incarcerated. So that means on March 1st, 2020, 12,409. On October 1st, 2021, today, there are 9,355 people who are incarcerated. So there are considerably fewer people in prison and jail today than there were at the onset of the pandemic. Our reporting has showed that a big piece of that is because there's people going out the back door who aren't being replaced at the front door, or at least that's what it was during April when we wrote that article. It's not a mass exodus. It's that simply that the churn of people going in the front door and out the back door has stopped, and people are leaving and not being replaced by folks who are coming in.
So fewer arrests and incarceration, or at least fewer convictions and incarceration, is what you're saying.
Yeah. So the convictions is actually a key point. The unsentenced population is largely unchanged. The sentence population is mostly what has changed during the COVID-19 pandemic, which suggests that there's still a large number of pending cases. There's still a large number of people who are locked up for some form of community supervision violation, or who are held up on a bond, who are unable to post a bond, who are waiting on the outcome of their case. The sentence population has been pretty much the majority of where the significant decline has come from.
One more question about the crime rates as reported in that recent FBI information. From your reporting, do people believe the pandemic played a role in the changing crime rates, and maybe even in the specific types of crimes?
That's what Democrats have been saying, and that's what some of the national experts have been posturing. It's that, motor vehicle theft specifically have gone up, they say, because kids aren't in school. They don't have access to in-person services like therapy. Their cases are taking longer to be disposed of. The homicide rates, like we had talked about, potentially could be because there's this patchwork of smaller community systems that had a lot of disruption during the pandemic. The thinking among Democrats is that specifically motor vehicle thefts are going to go down, they say, as the pandemic tends to wind down. I would hesitate to say that it's winding down, but I would say that Democrats are thinking that as things get back to normal, quote unquote, whatever that winds up looking like, perhaps our numbers will go down.
You mentioned young people in responding to that question. So was the change in the motor vehicle theft attributed greatly to young people, to teenagers, as was the perception anyway when watching news reports over the past few months or throughout the summer?
So this is one of the more interesting data points of this entire argument. It's that young people, minors under 18, make up very little of the people who are actually arrested for these crimes. I mean, between 2010 and 2019, people under the age of 18 made up just 28% of those who were arrested for stealing cars. I think that police would often counter that they don't bother arresting these young people because they know they're just going to get out in a couple of hours. But that's a real important data point in this argument, in this conversation. You know, if we go strictly by arrest, it's that young people aren't even the ones who are responsible for the lion's share of these crimes, or at least they're not represented among those who are arrested for them.
We've been talking with Kellen Lyons, a reporter for the online news site CT Mirror. Kellen, thanks for your time today. We appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Certainly. This is The Full Story. I'm Tom Kuser. New Haven, Connecticut has not escaped the rising violence and murder rates currently plaguing our region and the nation. There were 5 shootings in just 1 4-day period back in September. Local lawmakers and law enforcement have scrambled to respond to this compromise in public safety. But some residents of the Fair Haven section of the city are not waiting for officials to act. They're interrupting violence by taking over a troublesome parking lot next to a local bar cafe. They're occupying the space with lawn chairs and music and games. And joining us now on Zoom are three of the community organizers, Kika Matos, Karen Du Bois-Walton, and Sarah Miller. Welcome to The Full Story.
Thank you for having us.
Certainly. Kika Matos, if we could start with you and take a moment to get to know you just a bit better. How long have you lived in Fairhaven?
I have lived in Fairhaven now for 16 years. I'm actually Karen Du Bois-Walton's neighbor. We live just a few houses away from each other and on the street where the Grand Cafe is located and where we have been engaging in violence interruption for the last 3 weeks.
And that's a term I would like to explore in just a few minutes, violence interruption. Interesting use of the words. You've been a longtime activist in immigration issues and criminal justice. What's the work that you do on these issues?
In New Haven, I do a lot of immigration advocacy and racial justice advocacy. And what I get paid for to do is I work at the Vera Institute of Justice, which is a national organization that is dedicated to seeking justice and reforming the criminal legal system and the immigration system.
Karen Du Bois-Walton, a neighbor of Kika Matos, as we've just learned, you work on, among other things, homelessness and housing issues.
I do. I am a 27-year resident of Fairhaven. Have owned my house on East Pearl Street for the last 21 years, raised two young men there, and love Fairhaven, but I've been really concerned about what's happening there recently. And my work is in affordable housing. I run Elm City Communities. We're the public housing authority for the city. And our goal is certainly through housing, but the larger goal is around how we break cycles of poverty in our community and how we pair housing services with opportunity and how we build stronger communities. And that is what we are working to do on the corner of East Pearl and Grand, is build a stronger community there and create different opportunities for families.
And Sarah Miller, how long have you been in Fairhaven?
My family and I've lived in Fairhaven about 20 years. I grew up in New Haven. I've lived here since I was 3 years old, and we moved out here about 20 years ago.
And one
Mostly
of the issues...
my husband wanted us to live here, so I just followed him.
And one of the issues you've been involved in is advocating for improvements in education. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I really got involved in public advocacy around my children, who are now 10 and 7, and trying to figure out where they were going to go to school and how we could be constructive partners with the school system.
So all three of you have spent lots of time in Fairhaven. You know the neighborhood, you know the city of New Haven quite well. How safe do you think people feel right now in Fairhaven, given the the several shootings that took place there recently?
Sure. I mean, this is Karen. And I, in talking with neighbors and myself, my experience and my family's experience, we have noted a real significant change in what it has felt like in our community over the past couple of years, and really, you know, escalated to a moment that led to our disruption of violence sort of initiatives that we've taken on at this corner. And that was related to a shooting that happened in a parking lot. In a bar where there's a significant amount of loitering, a significant amount of street level drug dealing, drug use in the open. But what has been a wonderful community to live in for 27 years? Recently, we have noticed a real shift where it does not feel safe in the way that it has felt, where we see not just on this corner, but we see open air drug dealing. We see sex work clearer in visible at all times of the day and night. We see people clearly in need of services around their addiction and drug use. We have experienced not just this shooting, but homicides, many other shootings, a level of violent crime. And what also has felt different is it has felt like there was less of a coordinated response to what's happening in the community than I've experienced over my time being here. So I would say it has felt less safe than I have experienced in my 27 years in New Haven.
Kikamatos, I'm sorry, go ahead, Sarah. Sarah,
I was just
going
to say, my kids have always felt safe. We've always felt safe letting them walk around the neighborhood. They walk around in the dark to see their friends around the corner. And this is the first summer where I didn't feel safe. We hear gunshots at night. My kids didn't know what a gunshot sounded like until this summer. And my 10-year-old, when we had the most recent shooting, when we were going by, said, "Is that another shooting?" And I didn't realize that he was really noticing it. And so I think it's really seeped into the psyche of people in the neighborhood. And there is a real feeling that things are kind of out of control and we have to step in.
And Kikamatos, your perspective on this, how safe or unsafe do people feel at this moment?
I've had conversations with my neighbors, and what I keep hearing is a combination of two things. One is they feel unsafe, but also they feel that the city has abandoned our neighborhood, that there seems to be no strategic response to the increase in crime in our neighborhood, and that when they call the police, when they talk to the city to ask about the kinds of services, the folks who are on the streets dealing drugs and the strung out addicts that we see and the strung out sex workers, that the city seems to shrug its shoulders and offer a litany of excuses as to why it can't do anything. So it's that toxic combination of a lack of security coupled with a feeling that the city really doesn't care.
Listeners are hearing this this program the first weekend in October. You've been working to interrupt the violence focused in that parking lot that Karen Du Bois-Walton mentioned for quite some time now, right? This is not something that's just happened the other day. This frustration has led to some community action that all three of you have helped to organize.
It has. One of the things after that shooting and the night of that shooting, we were out there that night and stood and looked around and observed what was happening and notably what wasn't happening at that time. And that next morning, the three of us were on a text chain and talking to each other and planning. By the following day, we had held a community meeting virtually that over 60 of our neighbors attended, where not just frustration was expressed, but the desire to take action and to do something. And from there, this idea was born that this was a corner in the middle of our neighborhood, right? Two blocks from Keke and I, two blocks from Sarah's home, that because of inaction from the city and because of a whole host of things was becoming a place that none of us felt safe. And we wanted to take that back. And so we borrowed from an idea that we read about in another place and said, we're going to bring our lawn chairs and we're going to sit out there and we're going to bring new life to that corner. And we're going to change what it feels like to be on that corner. And we're going to engage our neighbors and others from across the city from across the state have come and joined us. And we're going to do that to take that back. And we're going to do that also in a way that gets the attention and input of the landlord, the property owner there. And we're going to develop a strategy about this one particular institution, this corner bar that has become a problem. And so in addition to our occupying the space, we're also circulating a petition that we intend to submit to the Connecticut Liquor Commission and ask for some attention and ask for some intervention around this establishment's ability to keep its liquor license without being a good neighbor. And so we hope that this pressure will get some attention there and a real change for that corner. And I'm feeling it already. And I know Sarah and Keke can speak to that as well, but it feels different to be out there with neighbors with music and games and hula hooping and the other things we brought.
And this is all part of, and it's a term I think Kikamatos, you used before. It's all part of a strategy called violence interruption. Could you elaborate on that a bit? You read about this being used elsewhere. I think it was in a Minneapolis neighborhood, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah.
How does it work? You mentioned there's music, there's games, there's hula hoops, people in lawn chairs. It's an interesting scene you've set there, and perhaps one that most people would not associate with interrupting violence. Mm-hmm. How does it do that?
So this idea actually was something that was that Sarah brought to our attention, and it was shared to her by a Fairhaven neighbor after the Zoom meeting that we had, where over 60 neighborhood residents came together, and we quickly moved from frustration and anger at the city to, you know, deciding that we were going to act ourselves. If the city wasn't going to do it, well, we were going to do it. And Sarah shared an article with us, and this initiative took place in Minneapolis. It was an initiative that was faith-led. So a faith-led community decided that they were going to take their launch. They first identified all of the hotspots in their community, and then they decided that they were just going to park their lawn chairs there to try to interrupt the violence. The theory being that if those engaging in violence saw people reclaiming that space, that maybe the violence would decline. We took it up a step further. All of us love culture. And so we decided that we were going to not just encourage people to bring their lawn chairs, but we reached out to cultural artists and we asked them to come and take part in it. And we encouraged people to bring games. So I embarrassed myself hula hooping because there was this amazing hula hoop artist who came with her hula hoops and encouraged us to take part. The New Haven String Quartet came and performed this amazing combination of their entire repertoire was also very culturally competent. So there was music from Central Latin and South America. A Puerto Rican bomba group performed. And so every night we have been blessed by cultural artists who have said, we are with you, we're gonna join you. But the other beautiful thing is some of our neighbors brought pizza, they brought food, right? Some of our neighbors brought games and they've stuck around. And I've gotten to know people in my neighborhood that I didn't know before. So it's actually served multiple purposes that we never anticipated. And I know Sarah has been keeping tab of the crime statistics. So I'm wondering, Sarah, if I can turn it over to you now.
I wanted to ask Sarah also, what made you think that what worked in Minneapolis might work in Fairhaven? And then please share those statistics that I guess you're using to measure whether or not your violence interruption is indeed, putting a damper on the violence.
Honestly, I had some hesitation initially. I'm always hesitant about things that sort of take the pressure off the system, right? Where we say that we're just going to step in and we're just going to fix this little piece and not put pressure on the system to try to fix everything. So I had some hesitation about doing it at first, but I think in the end, it makes sense because we are such an engaged community and we are so organized and active and committed. And we know that if we organize something that is really meaningful and where people are going to be able to actually impact the situation, they will show up and they have. I can just give a quick example from last night. We had just a small group last night, a bunch of people who didn't know each other, game of Scrabble, and they were going for 2 hours. They're like two older white women and two young, I had never met before, playing Scrabble in this parking lot. It was pretty great. So in terms of statistics, there's been no police activity in the, no arrests, no cases created since we've been doing this for the past 16 days.
So you mean there's been no need for the police to show up because there have been no incidents?
There's clearly been dealing. There's clearly been stuff happening, but there's been nothing violent or any sort of disorder, breach of peace or anything that required the police to come in and write up a report.
How have city officials reacted to what you're doing? Karen Du Bois-Walton, what have you been hearing from City Hall? Anything?
One of the things that I had felt was missing was something New Haven had been known for, which was a community policing model that really engaged community. And so we have found within the police department, the assistant chief came out and we got pictures of him dancing with us to Kika's Bamba music, and the district manager has gotten engaged. And so we've seen some movement from the police department that we frankly have wanted to see for a long time. And I think that's a good thing. They are submitting their own packet to the Liquor Commission in support of a challenge to what's happening there. We have seen this city come out and pay attention to that corner in ways that they haven't, and talk to the property owner about making some improvements there, and you know, and holding them more accountable around the way they keep that space. So those are positive signs. But what I guess we're hoping for is a real strategy around Fairhaven, what's happening in our neighborhood, that brings to it. None of us expect or want to see ourselves arrest our way out of what's been happening in our community. And so what we're hoping to see is that this will trigger real investment in our community toward the root causes of what's happening here. You know, it's been great. We have been talking to some of the people that hang out in this area and bringing resources. Like, did you know that there's a New Haven Works that helps get people connected to jobs? Folks didn't know that. And they were excited to get that information because at the end of the day, what they want is a good way to be able to feed themselves and their families. Folks didn't know that there's a Yale pipeline into jobs at the university. But in talking to people, we're able to tell them about that and share that. I think what we're looking for is that the city embrace this kind of approach to addressing poverty, addressing the need for real addiction and treatment services, addressing the number of folks that are unhoused in our community, and that we'll do that in a comprehensive way that actually will get to the long-term and sustainable violence interruption.
I'm wondering, Karen, you talked about the city's response to it. Have you heard from people in other neighborhoods who see what you're doing and want to replicate it, want to follow up, and even neighborhoods from outside New Haven, other cities in the state? Have you heard from anyone there?
I can take that one. Sure. And I will say I don't have such a charitable response as Karen does about the city. I appreciate that she lifted the good. But I also want to point out that not once has the mayor shown up. He has not shown his face. He has not expressed any sentiments of support. He has not reached out to us in any way, shape, or form to ask about our experience and seek our input. Same with the chief of police. She too has been missing in action. We see the lieutenant from our district, and we see the deputy chief of police, who has made it a point to be there on several occasions. But at the very top of the chain of command or the leadership in this city, neither one of them, the chief of police, Dominguez, and Mayor Elicker, have not made it. It does not appear that we are their priority. In terms of other people from the different neighborhoods, the beautiful thing is we have seen every day that we've been out there, we have seen people from different neighborhoods showing up and spending time. And we have heard from several people in different neighborhoods that they too want to stand up a similar initiative. Yesterday evening, I was at an event in Hartford, and a friend of mine came up to me and she said, I just want to let you know, I haven't been to the Grand Cafe parking lot, but I am on Karen's Facebook every night, and I'm watching what you all are doing, and I want to get involved in my neighborhood, and I want to do the same thing. So it feels like that we are having a positive impact in our neighborhood, but we're also encouraging other people in different communities to be a part of the solution, and to be a part of the solution in the holistic way that Karen described, right? We're not looking at the solution as cops, you know, cracking heads and locking people up, but really comprehensively trying to get at the root causes of why this is happening, but also in a way where we are showing up with a lot of love and commitment to our neighbors and our communities.
How long do you intend on repeating the daily occupation of the parking lot? As long as it takes, or do you have an end date in sight, Sarah Miller?
I'm going to take. Sure. So tonight is the last night of September, so this will be our last night for this phase. So we have a big celebration tonight. Mm-hmm. We have a Dixieland band, we have a church choir coming, so there'll be a lot happening tonight to kind of put an end. We said we would be there till the end of the month. We are trying to meet with the landlord and the businesses next week to try to agree on some like mutual commitments going forward as a sort of outgrowth of what we've done. And then we'll look at other hotspots in the city, in the neighborhood, and decide how we're going to proceed from there. But I know last night, you know, folks were saying, we got to keep this going. We got to keep, you know, keep it moving and not just, you know, do this for a little bit and then stop. I think what you see is that when you are consistent, it really does have an impact. They expect to see us there.
Yeah, I wonder, will the problem come back once you stop?
Well, I think that's the goal of trying to come up with some mutual commitments from the police and also from us. And maybe we'll be there once a week or, you know, whatever the commitment is in terms of our continuing presence. But I think the message, and Kika sort of alluded to this, you know, some of the frustration in terms of citywide policy is we would like to see a strategy like this that is human-centered, that is about people being in community with other people, building relationships, providing support. We don't really see street outreach workers in Fairhaven. We don't see the kind of work and presence that we're providing. We don't see in any other way. So we'd like to see that implemented programmatically and policy-wise. So that it's not, you know, it's not on, it's great for neighbors to stand up and do this for a while, but it really needs to be implemented in other ways that are more sustainable long-term.
Karen DeBob Walton, you mentioned before you don't want to take the pressure off of off the city as far as getting involved with this. And Sarah Melia mentions that you'd like to see something a little more codified or formalized when it comes to this kind of attention that neighborhoods could use in their efforts to stem the violence. Can you be more specific, maybe, Karen DeBoer Walton, about what it is the city could do? You know, around the country, there's talk about repurposing some of the funding that goes to police departments, for instance, dealing with issues that perhaps social workers or others would be more qualified to deal with as opposed to a uniformed officer. Can you talk a little bit more about what the city might be able to do, or perhaps even the state might be able to do something that could be replicated in other cities, in other neighborhoods around Connecticut?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we're at this moment of having this conversation when we also have an unprecedented amount of federal money coming into cities as part of the COVID relief. And it's meant to come to exactly the kind of community that Fairhaven is, right? That those dollars are supposed to go to the places that were most deeply impacted by historical racism, by current day racism, and where we saw the COVID disparities on display very clearly. And so we're looking for investments here, again, that get to some of the root causes. I want to see not a lot of police cameras and more police equipment in community. I want to see a connection to job opportunities. I want to see real outreach that's at the time of day that people are out on the street connecting people to drug treatment, addictions treatment services. I want to see real harm reduction models. You know, not just we're not going to arrest, but harm reduction means connecting that approach to getting people connected to treatment. And I want to see a shift where we don't expect that because this is a predominantly Latino and African American community that we just expect that this is the way things are going to be. What we are living with is not tolerated in the communities within New Haven that are predominantly white. It is not tolerated in communities that have higher income. It's not tolerated in our suburban neighborhoods just a mile up the road. And so these kinds of investments that get people into real jobs, into treatment opportunities, that shift the thinking from more policing being the solution to more community investment being the solution. And the small examples we've had of how engaged people are when we offer resources around jobs or housing is just a small sample of what could be done with these federal investments. I just offer one quick story, which is we had an amazing situation of people coming together on our site that resulted in somebody who's been struggling to figure out how to make a living, end up with an amazing job offer that came about because of the connections that were made on our little corner during our Occupy the Grand Cafe parking lot. And he is now off to a salary job with benefits that might lead to a whole different shift in what he can provide for himself and his family. And That's what I want to see us investing in. And that's what we have an opportunity, I think, to do with the over $100 million that are coming into the city as part of the COVID relief.
Kika Matos, anything to add to what Karen had to say?
Not a whole lot. I think Karen captured our sentiments beautifully. I mean, I would say I want to see our community being given the same level of priority as, you know, wealthier white communities. I want expressions, real expressions of commitment from the leadership in the city. I want New Haven to go back to the New Haven Police Department, to go back to real community policing. You know, we are known, or once known as a city that was, that pioneered community policing. Community policing is dead. No one believes that community policing exists in New Haven anymore. I want our police officers to make an effort to get to know people in our communities and to really limit their engagement around law enforcement to violent crime. And for us to find other solutions in other departments within the city that focus on treating the underlying conditions that lead people to live desperate lives.
I'm wondering, you mentioned, Karen, about the money coming into the states in terms of pandemic relief. Who paid the bills for the nightly occupation in the parking lot?
Everyone volunteered their time. All the artists volunteered their time. Mm. People sent us food. We would have pizza. People call us, I ordered you pizza. There's a pizza place across the street. Ordered your pizza for tonight. Like almost every night, there's been somebody sending food to, for folks.
And Sarah Miller, you touched on this a bit already, but what's next? What's next for this project, for this violence interruption effort?
Well, I think we circle back with our community. So like I said, we're going to try, we're going to kind of come up with some agreements about this plaza in particular. And we're going to pull our community back together and report and reflect on everything that we've done and map out what we want to do next, looking, you know, with a focus on other hotspots in the neighborhood and how we want to intervene going forward. But I think people, you know, we've had tremendously positive feedback on what we've done, not just in terms of its effectiveness at changing the dynamic in that particular space, but in terms of bringing our neighbors back together. And I'll just, you know, I'll just add, we know that gun violence is rooted in unmet needs, and we have to focus on meeting those needs if we want to resolve it. And we've just seen a proposal from the city to spend $3.8 million on cameras, security cameras across the city. And it just represents to me a huge missed opportunity to invest in the kind of street level, human level support work that we know is what people really need in order to get back on their feet.
Do you think the pandemic played a role in the increase in violence in the neighborhood? Karen DuBois-Walton?
I think that the pandemic has certainly played a role. I think that we're seeing what happens when communities are frayed at the edges and in the deep roots that tend to hold us together. And so I think there is a tremendous amount of stress that this community has been on, but that's piled upon a history of hundreds of years of underinvestment and inequities in these communities. And so I think it blew the top off of what was already a very challenged area. But we have folks who have experienced greater economic instability than they had before. We have folks who have been under a great emotional stress and anxiety for over 19 months at this point. We have people whose social connections were disrupted as we had to retreat into isolation. And so I think all of that has played a role in what we're seeing right now.
And Kika Matos, what about you?
The only thing I would add is one of the things that, you know, to Karen's earlier point about neglected neighborhoods and our neighborhood being the subject of historic neglect, and the fact that we are a neighborhood with a majority people of color, a working class neighborhood, predominantly Latine and African American. Our neighborhood was also one of the hardest hit by the pandemic. And so one of the things that we pushed hard for and we did advocacy around was to try to get the state to bring additional resources to our neighborhood to facilitate vaccination efforts and That was also a source of frustration for us because, once again, what we saw was hugely inadequate responses to our neighborhood. A disproportionate number of frontline workers lived in our neighborhood. Huge numbers of people disproportionately were getting COVID-19. A lot of undocumented immigrants who lived in our neighborhood were getting sick and they didn't get the support from the federal government. And so do I think COVID affected, has impacted violence without looking at any empirical studies? I would say anecdotally, absolutely.
I want to thank all three of you for your time today and letting us know what you're doing toward a solution to preventing violence in the Fairhaven section of New Haven. We appreciate it.
Thank you. If you're up for a game of dominoes, please join us this evening.
Okay.
Come on down. You're invited.
Thank you very much. We've been talking with Kika Matos, Karen DuBois-Walton, and Sarah Miller, three of the community organizers responsible for violence interruption in Fairhaven in New Haven, Connecticut. We asked New Haven Mayor Justin Elicker's office for comments, but didn't hear back by airtime. How about your neighborhood? Is crime on the rise? What are you doing about it? Let us know. You can email us at tfs@wshu.org, and we're on Twitter, too, at FullStoryWSHU. That's it for our program today, produced by Fatou Sangare and senior producer Ann Lopez. I'm Tom Kuser. Thank you for listening to The Full Story.